but in his early adult years failed to find the conviction he needed to pursue it. Many different things attracted him: music, religion, mysticism, writing poetry, drugs, writing pulp fiction, money, none of them permanently. He took whatever jobs came along, and because of his natural and varied talents, he did whatever he did well. But even then, none of the jobs turned into anything with a future, at least not a future that attracted him. After leaving college at midterm, he drove to New York City to study art, quickly changed his mind, and joined the army, which sent him to Korea. His father died suddenly, bringing him home to care for his mother and two younger siblings. Sometime after, he met an exciting woman, took off to Europe, where they traveled from country to country on a motor scooter, and where he played saxophone and drew religious figures on the streets in front of cathedrals to earn enough money to eat. Finally, out of money and tired of the game, he and his woman friend were repatriated by the U.S. government and returned to New York City, where they contracted to drive a New York City yellow cab to L.A. to deliver it to its new owner. When he was 25, they married, had two children, moved to San Francisco, where the young man sold encyclopedias for a living, played saxophone on occasion, and became, over time, less young. Their life was a running battle. Eventually, after one too many rages about his wife's abuse of alcohol, her infidelity, and his lack of purpose, the whole thing came tumbling down into divorce. He immediately met a much younger woman, whose eyes shined like his ex-wife's didn't, who read his poetry and was touched by it, who listened to his music and was awed by it, was satisfied just to sit by his side, no questions asked. And though he continued to sell encyclopedias, and though his heartfelt need for connecting with something that smacked of purpose continued to pain him privately throughout all of this, his life took a more positive turn with this new young woman who eventually became his second wife. He went back to college, left the book business, studied contracting and construction so he could work with his hands rather than his mouth, moved with his new willing wife to Southern California, and maneuvered himself into framing jobs from which he was fired time after time until he learned how to pull it off. By this time, he was a man in his late 30s, beginning to do work that kids 20 years younger than him did. They regarded him on the job as something of a freak. His beard by now was down to his chest, his hair hung down over his shoulders, he wrote poetry at night, played jazz on the weekend, ate burritos with the Mexicans on the job, smoked dope in the evenings, and dreamed crazily about the future when he and his young wife would buy 20 acres in Mendocino County, build their own house with their own hands, raise a family, and have his two girls from his first marriage move in with them when everything was ready. They had a tiny one-bedroom house in Santa Ana, California, drove a 52 Chevy pickup, and along with their Great Dane named Dan and a little black poodle named Murray, they lived in a sense-streaming daze that seemed at the time close to what the perfect life must be like. But as with all good things, this too came to an end when our young man, turning older, pursued by the demons of some indefinable muse, decided to move back north now that they had their act together, saved up enough from living the right life, hands crusted and gnarly from honest work, body brown and beautiful from putting his muscles on the line, brain filled with the poetry he had written, the music he had renewed, and the dope he had smoked, knowing that it was time to become the contractor he had set out to become 3 years before, and that all it would take was one sizable kick to get them moving toward what he knew would be the fine resolution of his up-to-now raggedy search. He and his wife and his Great Dane Dan and his poodle named Murray, plus whatever else they had accumulated in the few years he spent working with his hands rather than his mouth in Southern California, piled it all up in the 52 Chevy pickup and moved back to San Francisco they had come from not that long before. It was then that the big shift took place and the unpredictable happened. Our now 38-year-old hero and his young wife, along with the dogs and the pickup, were invited to move in temporarily with his sister and her husband while negotiating the purchase of their Mendocino acres. His brother-in-law had the idea that our hero would do well consulting in the area in which he was a tested expert, sales, with his advertising agency's high-tech small business clients, until such time, of course, that our hero settled down with his young bride on their Mendocino acres to follow his true calling. Understand, everyone knew that that was going to happen. Nobody doubted it. Full of the robust idealism that had marked his youthful passing, he was, without any doubt whatsoever, going to realize his vision. The 20 acres were all but his. It simply required the doing. Of course, there was also the contractor's license and the money, but no one thought that any of that would prove insurmountable. After all, here was a man who had lived a life that baffled good reason. Whatever he chose to do, he did. Whatever he did, he was good at. No matter that once he did it, he grew tired of it. He chose to do that too. To his friends and his family, he was, if not unexplainable, certainly someone to be noticed, at times in amazement, and at times with pity, but never without awe. Because who knew what this man was going to do next? And somehow, they all, in their own private way, envied him. Can you believe that? They envied him because he seemed so free. Despite the perpetual trouble he found himself in, despite his lack of direction, despite his whimsical and sometimes dangerous philosophy, there was no denying it. This man, although getting older, sometimes precipitously, was living a romantic adventure they write movies about. Or if not that, a pitiful tragedy. By anyone's standards, he was living pretty close to the edge. Here's a guy on the cusp of middle age with a long beard, a young wife, two dogs, and a pickup, without a home of their own, living with family, searching for property they couldn't possibly afford, with hardly a thought in his head that anything was wrong at all with his picture. About to step on those moving stairs to somewhere that he was totally unprepared for. And take the step he did, and it was a stunner. He was, thanks to his brother-in-law's good intentions, suddenly set adrift in a world that could have been another planet for all he knew. In Silicon Valley, calling on techies who own businesses whose names he couldn't even pronounce at first attempt, making stuff he didn't even know existed. He was dumbfounded by the magnitude of his ignorance, and yet something called him to stay. They asked him, "How can you help me?" He answered, "I don't know." They asked him, "What do you know about my business?" He answered, "Nothing." They looked at him for a long time. He sat and looked back and just thought. They said to him, "Why don't you come back after you've had some time to think about it?" He said he would, and he did, because he knew something was there. Understand, here's a guy who had been selling encyclopedias to people at night in front of their television sets or on the dining room table. Watching their faces suspiciously regard him as someone who came out of the night, until he spread out the encyclopedia and the vividly colored panels that showed all the books graphically alive, the maps, the transparencies of the human body, the endless list of topics, of wonders the world withheld from them in their ordinary lives, the promise to their children, even their children to come, of education, of knowledge, of information, long before the information age had arrived. Here their eyes would awaken and lighten up to all these colorful pictures of what was possible. And now, almost within their reach, pending a decision. He had done that late at night, grinding away in front of Frank and Marge until finally Frank, with his last breath, would say sort of covertly, "Well, Marge, what do you think? Think we should do it?" And he would sit there, our 30-something hero, waiting without a movement, without a whisper of encouragement to Marge, let alone to Frank, waiting for the inevitable yes or no, either of which would turn him back out into the night to, if he was lucky, go another round at Ben and Mary's, with all the little kids hanging on the pictures and making messes on his laminated plates. To this guy, this world, this Silicon Valley was a miracle. And I get to do this during the day? And so visit them he would, all the while feeling stupid, knowing nothing about their world or their business or the little weird things they made there, the little black boxes with their arcane significance so far beyond his experience of coffee tables and poetry and music and framing and pitching and closing. This intricate little world of theirs that lived in some cubicle inside of their foreign, tight, screwy little brains. And yet intuitively, he knew that he knew something they needed. He knew that there was something waiting there for him, something his particular life had in some strange, inexplicable way prepared him for. Something only someone who had lived in such an unconscious, cataclysmic, totally disorganized, yet always passionate state, doing this and that, could fully appreciate. And it was then that the curtain lifted. The curtain between the world that was theirs and the world that was his. But most of all, the curtain that stood between himself and himself. The curtain that separated him from his life. It was then that he realized with a suddenness that made him giddy that while he didn't understand their business, neither did they. And in that one shuddering instant of truth, our hero was reborn. He discovered an entirely new life. And with the discovery of his new life, there came for the very first time in his life the beginning of some purpose. To never let the curtain down again. To never allow the curtain to cover what was hiding there behind it. That the world was nothing like he had believed it to be. That no one knew what he had believed they knew. That everything was just like he thought it was, a mystery. But that he wasn't the only one who didn't know what was going on. What he learned in Silicon Valley is that no one knew what was going on. It was completely open to interpretation. And his guess was as good as anyone's. My God, probably even better. After all, he had met Frank and Marge face to face. He had survived the worst of the worst confrontations. He had even been attacked by a German shepherd dog while he was attempting to make his final close, right across the kitchen table. Who in Silicon Valley could say that and live to tell about it? Yo, and he had even made the sale, walked out with a torn contract in hand and a check. Who said little black boxes were dangerous? Who said there was anything to fear, anything he couldn't understand? I stopped long enough to feel how much this story had touched Sarah and how much she wanted to ask the obvious question, but I had to finish, so I went on. And so that chapter of our hero's life was closed and a new chapter opened. He moved into his early 40s and the end of his second marriage, which also, by this time, had produced a child, his third daughter. another love of his life who could not, as no child can ever do, repair a broken marriage. During the years that followed, he became about the best anyone could be in his new chosen profession. He learned the secrets he thought were hidden. He married a woman far bigger than the others, had two more children, fought battles with his ignorance at times titanic in scope, moved through one obstacle after another, wrote books, spoke throughout the world, built a great business, only to watch it almost fail, persisted in building it up again, lanced, jabbed, wrestled, grappled, laughed, sang, loved and roared, and through it all remembered one simple thing that meant more to him than anything else he had ever thought. The curtain. The curtain. Keep the curtain up at all cost. Because it is the curtain that kept him shrouded in darkness. And it's the darkness that holds out the light. It is the light, the openness, the clearing of all the obstacles to knowing that had become his true purpose, to be open, to be awake, to be available to what's really going on, to give up false beliefs. And for only one reason, his life was at stake. And that's the point, Sarah. It's not your business you have to fear losing. It's something much bigger than that. It's yourself. And that's what this whole thing is about. What truths are your curtain holding from you? What misunderstanding keeps you where you are, in the past, in the dark, shrouded in your limited beliefs, shrinking from the world, from the light on the other side of the curtain? Until you lift the curtain, Sarah, until you dare to pull the mask off the world's face, until you move beyond your comfort zone, you will never know what it is you are missing out there. It's you, Sarah. It's you that's waiting out there for you to find on the other side of the curtain. I know, Sarah, because the man I've been telling you about is me. When the curtain lifted, I learned something. That there's no one else out there but you. Chapter 13. Your Strategic Objective. Your arrows do not carry, observed the master, because they do not reach far enough spiritually. Eugene Herogel, Zen and the Art of Archery. Once you have a picture of how you want your life to be, and you come to the realization that it's more than just things to have and things to do, once you realize that what you and I really want is to have the room, the openness to expand, to grow, to be more of ourselves, whatever that means, and to find out what that means is what's most important to us, once you see that, you can then turn to the business that's going to help you get there. You can then turn to the development of your strategic objective. Your strategic objective is a very clear statement of what your business has to ultimately do for you to achieve your primary aim. It is the vision of the finished product that is and will be your business. In this context, your business is a means rather than an end, a vehicle to enrich your life rather than one that drains the life you have. Your strategic objective is not a business plan. It is a product of your life plan as well as your business strategy and plan. Your life plan shapes your life and the business that is to serve it. Your business strategy and plan provide the structure within which your business is intended to operate over time to fulfill your life plan. Your business strategy and plan are a way of communicating to anyone you must communicate to the direction your business is going, how it intends to get there, and the specific benchmarks it will need to hit in order for the strategy and plan to work. Your business strategy and plan are also useful for marketing your business to those who are important to you, your banker, your investors, and your strategic alliances in the business community. But unless your business strategy and plan can be reduced to a set of simple and clearly stated standards, it will do more to confuse you than to help. Your strategic objective is just such a list of standards. It is a tool for measuring your progress toward a specific end. It is designed for implementation, not for rationalization. It is a template for your business to make certain that the time you invest in it produces exactly what you want from it. Let's take a closer look at some of the standards that need to be included in your strategic objective. The first standard, money. The first standard of your strategic objective is money, gross revenues. How big is your vision? How big will your company be when it's finally done? Will it be a $300,000 company? A $1 million company? A $500 million company? If you don't know the answer, how can you possibly know whether your business can help you realize your primary aim? But gross revenues alone are not enough. You also have to know what your gross profits are going to be, your pre-tax profits, your after-tax profits. At this point, you come face-to-face with the first dilemma encountered by everyone going into business. How can you possibly know now what your business is going to produce in sales that far in the future? The answer is, you can't. But it doesn't matter. At the beginning of your business, any standards are better than no standards. Creating money standards is not just strategically necessary for your business, it is strategically necessary for your life, for the realization of your primary aim. Indeed, the first question you must always ask when creating standards for your strategic objective is, what will serve my primary aim? The first question about money then becomes, how much money do I need to live the way I wish? Not in income, but in assets. In other words, how much money do you need in order to be independent of work, to be free? In fact, there is ultimately only one reason to create a business of your own, and that is to sell it. To do it, to finish it, and then to get paid for it. Just like Ray Kroc did, to create your franchise prototype, to turnkey your business, to create a business that really works, and then sell it. How much do you want for it? 10 times earnings? 20 times earnings? When do you want it? 3 years from now? 5 years? Why would anyone buy it? Because it works. And it works because you built it that way. You built it so that it would work better than anyone else's business. You invented a turnkey solution to your specific kind of business's problems. A little money machine. An absolutely predictable little business that does what it promises to do every single time. A business that can give you everything you want. And because it can give you everything you want, it can give your prospective buyer everything he wants. At this point, another set of standards are immediately brought into the picture. Because once you've created a set of financial standards for your life, once you know what it is your business needs to provide you with as a return on your investment, it becomes obvious that the business must have a realistic chance of achieving those standards, of producing that return on your investment. How can you know whether or not it does? By determining whether your business is an opportunity worth pursuing. The second standard, an opportunity worth pursuing. An opportunity worth pursuing is a business that can fulfill the financial standards you've created for your primary aim and your strategic objective. If it is reasonable to assume that it can, the business is worth pursuing. If it is unreasonable to assume that it can, then no matter how exciting, interesting, or appealing the business is, forget it. Walk away from it. It will consume too much of your precious time and prevent you from finding a true opportunity worth pursuing. How do you know whether you have an opportunity worth pursuing? Look around. Ask yourself, does the business I have in mind alleviate a frustration experienced by a large enough group of consumers to make it worth my while? This standard fulfills two primary requirements of your strategic objective. It tells you what kind of business you're creating, while it defines who your customer will be. It tells you what you need to sell and to whom. What kind of business am I in? Ask anyone what kind of business they're in, and they'll instinctively respond with the name of the commodity they sell. We're in the computer business, or we're in the hot tub business. Always the commodity, never the product. What's the difference? The commodity is the thing your customer actually walks out with in his hand. The product is what your customer feels as he walks out of your business. What he feels about your business, not what he feels about the commodity. What he feels about the experience doing business with you. Understanding the difference between the two is what creating a great business is all about. Charles Revson, the founder of Revlon, and an extraordinarily successful entrepreneur, once said about his company, "In the factory, Revlon manufactures cosmetics. But in the store, Revlon sells hope. The commodity is cosmetics. The product, hope." In a Chanel television commercial in the 1980s, an incredibly handsome man and a strikingly beautiful woman are alone while music plays hypnotically in the background. The scene shifts quickly and frequently to other shots, such as a tall, erect building. So far, there hasn't been a sound except for the music that supports this suggestive visual ballet. The black shadow of an airplane moves vertically up the building. She approaches him. The music continues. He says, "Can I ask you a question?" In a voice filled with intimacy and invitation. We don't hear her answer. We just see her tilt her head back, close her eyes, and open her mouth slightly. Suddenly, the message, "Share the fantasy, Chanel." Not a word about perfume. That's the commodity. The commercial is selling the product. Fantasy. Intimacy. Connection. The commercial is saying, "Buy Chanel, and this fantasy can be yours." What's your product? What feeling will your customer walk away with? Peace of mind? Order? Power? Love? Intimacy? What is he really buying when he buys from you? The truth is, nobody's interested in the commodity. People buy feelings. And as the world becomes more and more complex and the commodities more varied, the feelings we want become more urgent, less rational, more unconscious. How your business anticipates those feelings and satisfies them is your product, and the demographics and psychographics associated with your customer will predetermine how you do that. Who is my customer? Every business has a central demographic model. That is, a most probable customer. And that customer has a whole set of characteristics through which you can define him. Age, sex, income, family status, education, profession, and so forth. Demographics is the science of marketplace reality. It tells you who your customer is. Your central demographic model customer buys for very particular reasons, none of which are rational or even explicable. Yet he buys or he doesn't. The motivations that propel him in either direction constitute your central psychographic model. Psychographics is the science of perceived marketplace reality. It tells you why your customer buys. So when you ask, is this business an opportunity worth pursuing? The only way to tell is to determine how many selling opportunities you have, your customer's demographics, and how successfully you can satisfy the emotional or perceived needs lurking there, your customer's psychographics. Standards 3 through how many? There is no specific number of standards in your strategic objective. There are only specific questions that need to be answered. When is your prototype going to be completed? In 2 years? 3? 10? Where are you going to be in business? Locally? Regionally? Nationally? Internationally? How are you going to be in business? Retail? Wholesale? A combination of the two? What standards are you going to insist upon regarding reporting, cleanliness, clothing, management, hiring, firing, training, and so forth? You can begin to see that the standards you create for your business will shape both your business and the experience you have of your business. In fact, the standards of your strategic objective create the tension that draws the future model of your business and the way it actually appears today closer to one another. As we saw earlier, standards create the energy by which the best companies and the most effective people produce results. It was 11 o'clock Monday morning, 1 week following my last meeting with Sarah. It was the one day of the week All About Pies was closed. We decided to spend the day together to talk about her business. As she walked up to the table in the restaurant where we had decided to meet, I could see her excitement. She was a much different Sarah than when I had seen her a week earlier. Her eyes were clear, her body exuberant. She looked much younger. She also looked like she had a lot to talk about. The restaurant was owned by a friend of mine. We had done a lot of work together in his startup years, and so it was a place where I could take a table and spend as much time as I needed without being rushed out the door. In fact, it was a wonderful place to provide a new client with some clarity about what a business could do when done well. Sarah sat down and immediately began to talk. I poured her some coffee. It seems for the first time in my life, I truly have come to some understanding about what I want. It is important for me to tell you how much I appreciate what you've given me, Sarah said. But having said that, I realized from almost the moment you left last week that I would never allow myself again to be consumed by the work of my business. It became obvious to me, with a clarity that's almost impossible to describe, how big a price I've been paying for being so obsessed with my work. And once I realized it, I swear, it was like I was suddenly and forever free of it. Something truly freeing happened to me that night, she continued. And it's not as though I haven't been working for the past 6 days. I have. Business has to go on after all. But this past week was not the way it was before. While one part of me was doing the work, I guess that's the part you would call the technician, part of me stayed removed from it. Part of me wasn't taken at all by the work I was doing. And remember how I told you that I didn't think I was entrepreneurial? Well, I suddenly realized that I am. That I've always had an entrepreneurial part in me. That's what you call the entrepreneur. I've always thought of it as my spirit. Sarah continued, "My spirit is what my aunt called it. She used to say to me, 'Sarah, feed your spirit. It is your spirit which gives you life.' I remember as a little girl, it was my spirit that always got me into trouble. It was my spirit that my teachers complained about so much. They used to say to my parents, 'If it weren't for Sarah's spirit, she'd be doing much better in school than she does.' It was my spirit that would dream when I was in the classroom, rather than pay attention to what was going on around me. I used to fantasize about things all the time. My head went to the strangest places. Anything could set me off. And while that part of me would really seem to tick my teachers and my parents off, my aunt always seemed to nurture it. 'You need to be very gentle with your spirit, Sarah,' she used to say to me. 'It needs to be free, but it also needs you to direct its attention. Too much of one and not enough of the other, and your spirit will take off like a wild horse. That's how you need to think of your spirit, Sarah, like a wild horse. Part of it is there to serve you, and another part to serve itself. The thing you need to learn is which part is which. If you put it behind a fence, you will kill it. But if you leave it to come and go as it pleases, you will never understand it. And I see that's what I've been doing these past 3 years,' Sarah said to me. 'I've put a fence around my spirit, around my entrepreneurial nature, without even realizing it. But what I really came to understand this past week is that I've been doing that, putting a fence around my spirit, for a long, long time. My parents taught me how to do it. My teachers taught me how to do it. And like a good little girl, I learned the lesson well. But now, the wild horse is free. Now I'm back in the kitchen with my aunt again. Now I really understand what my aunt was doing with me in the kitchen all those years ago. She wasn't teaching me how to bake pies. She was baking me. She was teaching me about the wild horse, about my spirit, about creativity. And when you talked about the entrepreneur, it all came back to me with a rush. My aunt, the kitchen, the pies, the dreaming in the classroom, the secret places I used to go hide when I was a little girl, and how I stopped hiding in those places a long time ago, and how much I miss it. What I've come to realize is that I've confused baking good pies with what my aunt was really talking to me about. I thought that baking good pies was it, when it wasn't. It never has been, and it never will be again. So back to my business,' she continued. 'It's clear to me now that what I wish to do is to develop it, grow it, and be free of it, to do whatever else it is I wish to do, even though right now, at this very moment, I couldn't for the life of me tell you what that is. Try,' I said. 'Try to tell me as best you can.' She smiled. 'You're just like my aunt. You never let me off the hook either.' 'Okay, I'll try. Why not? What else do we have to do?' She closed her eyes for a moment and seemed to gather herself. And then she began to speak softly, as though to herself. 'I'm a little girl again. When I still had my hiding places, before I lost my spirit. It's summer, and I'm lying in bed looking up at the ceiling in my room, feeling the cool summer breeze floating through the open window. There's nothing I have to do. There's no place I have to be. It's the most wonderful feeling of my life, lying here like this, opening my eyes, closing them, dreaming, smelling the wonderful summer smells, the smell of cut grass, the smell of the water sprinkling on the lawn, the fullness of it. And then I begin to dream, first in colors, nothing specific, just colors floating above my head like crystals and flowers and blossoms of light in glowing colors. And then the colors take form. They are me, and they are also something else. I'm walking by the stream that runs across our land, about 500 feet from the house, down where the four oaks stand. We have these four oaks, huge, gnarled trees that stand like a miniature forest at the corner of our property. My aunt and I called them four oaks, as though they were another country. And I used to go there as a little girl and imagine I was in another country. I'm in Four Oaks now, in my mind, as I lie there in my bed, as I used to do time after time. And it's there where my wild horse waited for me. He is standing in the center of the Four Oaks, his body glistening in the shade, black as black can be. I walk up to him and touch his face, and he shudders and pulls away from me. For a moment, we watch each other without moving, and then he's gone. He whirls around and speeds off, his mane and tail streaming out of the trees, through the stream, over the hill on the other side of the stream, and out of sight. I'm suddenly aware of the sweet summer breeze again, as it softly touches my face, and I'm in bed, hugging myself under the covers, thrilled to be alive on such a wonderful summer morning when there's nothing at all I have to do but this. Tears were streaming down Sarah's cheeks, tears of something precious, lost and then found. There was a radiant smile on her face. The tears also welled up in my eyes, watching her, understanding what this meant to her, and understanding at the same time what this meant to me. We ate lunch almost without talking, and then settled down into an afternoon of conversation. The waiter brought us a pot of tea. Sarah poured herself and me a cup, and then I began. "Tell me," I said, "now that you have a better feeling for what your business can do for you, why don't you try to describe it to me? Why don't you begin to describe your strategic objective?" "Okay," she began. "I've given some thought to this." She smiled almost bashfully. I was thinking to myself as she finished collecting her thoughts that I've seen that smile dozens, if not hundreds of times before when owners of a business begin to imagine their company as something bigger than they ever dared to imagine before, and as they tell it to me or to someone else. It's as though they're embarrassed to be seen imagining something bigger than they are, as though they're overreaching, being presumptuous. I suspect they must have experienced something similar when they were children, telling their parents or their teachers about a fanciful idea they had, and feeling the disappointment and shame that comes from being told that you're being unrealistic, that you're dreaming, hearing them say, "You can't do that," and finding themselves alone as children with their dreams that they dared not share again. How, without even realizing it, our parents and our teachers take our spirit away. But like I knew she would, Sarah continued without embarrassment now, fully taken by the picture she was describing. This was her business. This was her idea. And she could see it as clearly as anything. She said, "I see my business about 7 years from now. There are four locations, the one I have now and three more." She named the three communities adjoining hers. "The name of the business is the same. There's no need to change that. The business is all about pies, all about the experience of pies my aunt gave to me. It's that experience I wish to give to other people. not only my customers, but the people I hire. I want everyone to know, somehow, that All About Pies is a metaphor for something much finer. I see the shops producing annual sales of $450,000 each for a total of $1,800,000 a year. I'm not totally certain what the net profit will be, but I've decided that it should be about 15% or $67,500 for each shop for a total of $270,000 for the four. I feel that's a reasonable profit to shoot for, even though today I'm only producing about 11% after my income, I mean. That means if I sell the business in 7 years, given a realistic price-earnings ratio, I think it's called, I should be able to sell the business for more than $1 million. $1 million in 7 years, that's my dream, she said to me, smiling, as though she could already see the money in the bank. Because first, I won't ever need any more money than that to do everything I have ever wanted. And second, because it's really a great round number to shoot for. It sort of makes everything I need to do really concrete. Sarah continued. Before I can open my second shop, I realize I've got to get this one operating without me. And so one of the first things I'm going to do, and I've already begun to do this since we met last week, is to document all of the things I really know how to do today. For example, I know how to bake a great pie, and I know that I can document how I do that, so that's one of the first places I'm going to begin. But I'm getting ahead of myself. Let me tell you what my business will look like when it's done, so you can really get a feel of it. My aunt used to say that one of the problems we have in our lives is that we don't express our caring deeply or often enough. She used to say that when we were in the kitchen cutting the apples or something like that. She'd say, when we cut apples, we're doing something important. And God is giving us something important, not only the apple, which is important enough, but the kitchen and the knife and the company we're giving each other. So when we cut the apples, we need to remember that and hold them just right and slice into them with just the appropriate force, not too much, not too little. She would say, hold my hand while I cut the apple. Do you feel what I mean? Not too much and not too little. Too much, and you're taken away by the task. Too little, and the apple doesn't get cut. Anyway, in my business, I want to express not too much and not too little. I want the business to be an expression of our caring deeply and often enough. I want the business All About Pies to be all about caring, not about pies. And if the business is all about caring, then everything we do in the business, everything the business looks, acts, and feels like, she said to me with a smile, remembering the story I had shared with her about Tom Watson, then everything the business is will be a reflection of that, a reflection of caring. Caring will be the true product of my business, not pies. So I see All About Pies as a model for everyone who comes into contact with it. And what's so exciting about that is, I know I can do it. My aunt taught me how. I know what it means to care enough about the kitchen to scrub it down until it gleams. I know what it means to care enough about the knives to sharpen them until they're razor keen. I know what it means to select the finest fruit, to spend time smelling it, holding it, looking at it, to know exactly when it's ready. To make absolutely certain of that, my aunt planted her own garden, her own trees. And we would see that only the best of organic fertilizers were used. And so I know that All About Pies needs to grow its own fruit in its own gardens. And that's something I just realized this week. So I now feel certain that in order for All About Pies to become what I can imagine it to become, it won't be enough for my employees to just work in the shop. They need to learn everything just as I did when I was a girl working with my aunt. All About Pies will be to them what my aunt was to me. And I know I can do that, she said to me, again passionately. It's as real to me now as my aunt was to me then. So each shop will produce pies with fruit from a central organic garden, which means I'm going to have to find one to buy, or land that I'm going to have to plant centrally located between the shops so that each has the access it needs. What it also means is that the shops are only going to bake pies from fruit that's in season here, when it's in season. That's all my aunt ever did. I'm not going to use fruit from any place other than my own gardens, and that is going to be something unique about All About Pies that differentiates it from every other bakery or small pie shop, truly homegrown, with homegrown gentle care. But what's also exciting to me, Sarah continued, is that I realize that I've already done a lot of what I'm describing in my current shop. The floors are the best oak. The ovens are the best you can buy. The display cases are absolutely gorgeous. My aunt would have loved my place. And that's what I also realized while I was thinking about all of this, that if I'm ever in question about whether I'm doing it right or not, all I have to ask myself is, what would my aunt think? And I'll know the answer. Can you see it? She asked me honestly. Am I giving you a taste of what my strategic objective is? Am I being clear enough? Sarah, I smiled, you leave me speechless. Then what's next? She asked as she poured each of us a fresh cup of tea. Chapter 14, Your Organizational Strategy. All organizations are hierarchical. At each level, people serve under those above them. An organization is therefore a structured institution. If it is not structured, it is a mob. Mobs do not get things done. They destroy things. Theodore Levitt, Management for Business Growth. Everybody wants to get organized, but when you suggest that they start by creating an organization chart, all you get is doubtful and sometimes hostile stares. Don't be ridiculous, a client once retorted. We're just a small company. We don't need an organization chart. We need better people. Despite his protestations, I persisted, because I knew something he didn't. I knew that the organizational development reflected in the organization chart can have a more profound impact on a small company than any other single business development step. Organizing around personalities. Most companies organize around personalities rather than around functions. That is, around people rather than accountabilities or responsibilities. The result is almost always chaos. To best show you what I mean, let's take a look at Widget Makers, a new company formed by Jack and Murray Hopeful, brothers and now partners in an enterprise that they're sure will make them rich. Jack and Murray start their partnership, as most do, by sharing the work. When Jack's not making the widget, Murray is. When Jack's not helping the customer, Murray is. When Murray's not doing the books, Jack is. In the beginning, the business hums like a well-oiled machine. The shop is spotless. The windows gleam. The floors are meticulous. The customers smile. And Jack and Murray hustle. Taking turns, always taking turns. On Monday, Murray opens up. On Tuesday, Jack. On Wednesday, Murray. On Thursday, Jack. After all, they're partners, aren't they? If they don't do it, who will? It's only fair that they share the work. and they go on that way, and the business begins to grow. All of a sudden, there's more work than either Murray or Jack can handle. They have to get help. So they hire Jerry, a great guy, and a nephew to boot. As long as they have to pay someone, might as well keep it in the family. Now it's Jack, Murray, and Jerry, taking turns. When Jack's not doing the books, Murray is. And when Murray and Jack aren't, Jerry is. Now, when Murray isn't working with a customer, either Jack or Jerry is. Or when Jack isn't opening up, Murray is, or Jerry. Things are moving. The business is jumping. Jack and Murray and Jerry are as busy as three people can be. It isn't long before Herb joins them. Jack's wife's brother. A good guy. A hard worker. Willing and eager. Now it's Jack, Murray, Jerry, and Herb, taking turns. When Jack's not doing the books, Herb is, or Murray, or Jerry. When Murray's not working with a customer, it's Jack, or Jerry, or Herb. When Jerry's not making widgets, it's Murray, or Jack, or Herb. Everybody's opening up, everybody's answering the telephone, everybody's going out for sandwiches, everybody's making deposits, taking turns. But suddenly, the widgets begin to come back. They don't seem to be working like they used to. "We never had this trouble before," says Jack to Murray. Murray looks at Herb. Herb looks at Jerry. All of a sudden, the books begin to look funny. "We never had this trouble before," says Murray to Jack. Jack looks at Jerry. Jerry looks at Herb. And that's not all. The shop is beginning to fall apart. Tools are missing. Dust is getting in the widgets. Corrugated cardboard is strewn about the work table. Nails are in the screw boxes and screws in the nail boxes. Jack and Murray and Jerry and Herb are beginning to bump into each other on their way in and out. They're elbowing for room in the workspace. Windows aren't getting cleaned. Floors aren't getting swept. Tempers begin to mount. But who's to say something? And what? And to whom? If everybody's doing everything, then who's accountable for anything? If Jack and Murray are partners, who's in charge? If both, then what happens when Jack tells Jerry to do something that Murray won't allow him to do? When Herb wants to go for lunch, who does he tell? Jack? Murray? Jerry? Who's accountable for making certain that the store is manned? When the widgets go bad, who's accountable for correcting the condition? When the books are unbalanced, who's accountable for balancing them? When the floors need cleaning, when the windows need washing, when the shop needs opening or closing, when the customers need tending, who's accountable for producing the results? What Jack and Murray don't understand is that without an organization chart, everything hinges on luck and good feelings, on the personalities of the people and the goodwill they share. Unfortunately, personalities, good feelings, goodwill, and luck aren't the only ingredients of a successful organization. Alone, they're the recipe for chaos and disaster. Organization needs something more. Organizing your company. Let's start widget makers all over again. Jack and Murray Hopeful are sitting in their kitchen. They have decided to form widget makers. They are excited about its prospects, but know that if it's to succeed, they have to approach it differently from the way most people start a new business. The first thing they decide to do is to think about the business as a corporation rather than as a partnership. Rather than thinking of themselves as partners, they now think of themselves as shareholders. Having both worked in partnerships with other people and failed, Jack and Murray know that there's nothing more disastrous than a partnership gone bad, as so many do. Unless it's a family business, that is. Jack and Murray already know that family businesses are even worse than partnerships. but a partnership that's also a family business. No, Jack and Murray decide to do it a different way. Sitting there at the kitchen table, Jack and Murray each take a blank piece of paper and print their names at the top of the page.